House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2873.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2873 provides that retirement benefits for police officers and firefighters not provided through PERS are exempt from state, county, municipal taxes other than state-imposed personal income tax and inheritance tax.
We have Representative Barton and
a Barker.
We have Barton here and Barker there. And a retired firefighter in our midst.
Sure, Joe Gray.
That's right. Representative.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barker. I represent House District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. This bill is a simple fix. Back around 1990, and Mr. Gray will give you some history on that. Public employees don't have to pay income tax on local income tax districts. In Multnomah County a few years back had an ITAX, an income tax, and retirees who were federal retirees or PERS retirees did not have to pay it, but through an oversight, Portland police officers and Portland firefighters who were retired did have to pay it. So, for example, you could have the scenario of Representative Wisnant, if he'd lived in Multnomah County, retired from the Air Force. They had never lived in Oregon prior to that, would have been there and not had to pay the tax, or the postman would not have had to pay the tax, yet the firefighter or the policeman who lived there would. And if nobody had to pay the tax, we wouldn't argue about that at all. We'd be pleased to pay, or if everybody rather had to pay it, we would be pleased to pay it with it. But with this exemption, it's just an oversight that the Portland police and firefighter retirees did have to pay because we're not in PERS. It's a separate retirement system. And this is just a fairness issue. I'd be glad to answer any questions. I need to be at another meeting.
Any questions of Representative Barker before he goes?
Representative Hammer?
Okay. All right, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your attention.
Thanks, Joe.
Representative, we can't move it today. I guess we don't have the stuff, so, right?
Okay.
And then we'll get on with it. Go ahead, Mr. Gray. Welcome.
Yes, I'm Joe Gray, and I live in Oregon City, and I'm a retired firefighter from the city of Portland. Our situation is a little history on it, and prior to 1991, Portland firefighters and police officers were treated the same as PERS employees as far as their taxation on their pensions go. In 1991, state decided to tax everybody because of a problem that they were having with the federal employees who wanted to have the same treatment. And under the Davis Act, which was prior to 1989, the states were required to treat federal employees exactly the same as they treat the PERS employees of the state. So because of the tax issue and the amount of people you look at when you talk about the number of federal employees there are, it was a problem for the state. So they decided to tax everybody. And then the PERS employees, retirees, went to court. The Supreme Court says they have a contract. You can't tax them. But if you do tax them, you have to make them whole. So the 1991 legislature didn't finish that job. And the 1993 legislature went through it but couldn't come to any kind of a conclusion. The 1995 legislature said that they were going to make them whole, and along with that they passed legislation to treat Portland Fire and Police with the same situation. And at that time, and we had been covered for years and years and years as the same as PERS people. So we weren't aware of any problems until about 2005. Multnomah County passed a income tax that taxed the pensions of retirees. We are in a particular situation in the city and the county. We were the only people that paid that income tax that were public employees. And only part of the firefighters and police officers paid that, since we had taken in firefighters and police officers from what was at one time District 10 and Multnomah County, and also Clackamas County. They were all under PERS. So we had a mixture of firefighters and police officers who, working for the same department, who some paid the tax and some didn't. And that's the way it is today. Consequently, we wrote some legislation, and 2873, I think, covers that. I think it was the intent of the 95 legislature that we would be treated equally, and I think it was a glitch in the legislature. I don't think there was anything meaningful. I think that they actually thought we were completely covered the same as PERS was. And this particular bill would resolve that situation for us. And it basically boils down to a matter of fairness. When you work shoulder to shoulder with people, you expect to be treated in the same way. That's if I can answer any questions, I'd be more happy to answer any questions.
Before I open it up, Mr. Gray, I just want to first of all thank you for all your years of service. I know the committee shares that, and by a strange coincidence, our firefighter on the committee is stuck in traffic in 205. Representative Matthews is a firefighter in Gresham. I hope he gets here safely and doesn't have to get out of his car or truck and have to help, but you never know. I know he will if he has to, but I just want to thank you for your service. And I have not heard, nor is my administrator here, any negative hue and cry about this from anyone or from the department, PERS. We're just waiting for the fiscal and revenue summaries. Here comes our firefighter right now. Anyway, so I just wanted to thank you for your years of service.
Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Gray? Representative Kennemer, please.
Just a comment. I was there in 95, and I think it was a matter of equity for all.
Mm-hmm. All right, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak on House Bill 2873? All right, seeing no one, I'll close public hearing. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2849.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2849 directs the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation, otherwise known as SAFE, to develop recommended state medical malpractice insurance program to be administered by the corporation. The measure establishes a task force to report to an interim committee related to medical malpractice insurance in 2010. The task force is sunset on the opening day of the 2011 legislative session. There is an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
Good morning, Representative Bruin.
Good morning.
Thank you, sir. Are you going to do sign language to us?
Well, Representative Barton and I have already had a previous discussion on this bill, so I want to protect him and all.
Good morning, Mr. Chair of Committee. Thank you for having me. I'm Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37. Just a little bit of background, larger background on why I put forward, why Representative Greenlee and I have put forward House Bill 2849. The background is that both he and I, as well as most of the co-sponsors of the bill, serve on the House Healthcare Committee. And among other things that the House Healthcare Committee is working on this year is House Bill 2009, which is big and bodacious, to say the least. There are many points of view about what that bill will do, should do, how it will work, how it may not work, and we're sorting that out right now, and all of you will have, if you don't already, like Representative Kennemer, you will all see that bill fairly soon, and once again, it's the biggest thing I've ever seen while I've been in the legislature. As I said, there's going to be many differences of opinion on that bill, but one thing that everybody, I think, without any disagreement, agrees on is that for us to address comprehensive health care in any meaningful way, or for us to address the idea of ensuring more Oregonians and providing health care for more Oregonians, a critical, if not the critical element to that will be reducing costs. I mean, it's just that simple. I don't care what the part, it could be a complete free market program, it could be a complete government program, or it could be some sort of combination thereof, and that's sort of the way 2009 is heading right now. I, not to be pessimistic, but I have absolutely no doubt that if we cannot get our arms around legitimate cost management, that the ideas will fail. Medical, among all the things that drive healthcare, medical malpractice has been one of those things that has been a real cost driver, a real inflationary driver to the cost of healthcare, not only in Oregon but across the country. I think we've all seen and heard and read media reports about the double-digit annualized growth in medical malpractice. It's even worse than double digits. Sometimes it's in the order of 50, 60, even 100% increases in certain parts of the country, even in Oregon from time to time. Now, I think you'll see written testimony after I get done today, which shows that we've actually had a decrease in the annual inflation, in the annual malpractice, medical malpractice insurance rate. So that's a wonderful thing. But I think what you'll see within that testimony, written testimony, is that it has been a roller coaster, and that over any period of time, 10 years or however long you want to look, the cost increase has been just horrific. Most of you have heard this, but what that medical malpractice insurance does is a number of things. First of all, it obviously it inflates the cost of health care. Perhaps even more disappointingly, it keeps certain practitioners from practicing medicine. You've all heard the stories about the OBGYNs deciding not to practice, deciding to change their scope of practice because that medical malpractice insurance hits that particular discipline straight between the eyes. And you've also heard the stories about how high med mal insurance rates have kept practitioners from the rural parts of the states. And as we deal with just a general shortage of medical health care providers, both, I mean, from doctors to nurses to dentists to you name it, our ability to serve those rural areas becomes more complicated, and medical malpractice insurance is a big part of that. So I for one, and just parenthetically, and this is where Representative Barton might want to put the earmuffs on, I believe that we cannot solve the issue of medical malpractice rates without tort reform. And this bill here, 2490, even though it has nothing to do with tort reform, certainly wouldn't preclude us in any way, the state, from looking at what I think is needed, which is, and I know we're working on, which is tort reform. But that's not what this bill does. Very briefly, this bill is, frankly, it was a letter. The idea was given to me from a constituent that wrote me a letter, and basically it was this simple. He said, this state has had incredible successes in dealing with areas where insurance rates have been out of control, and he named two of them specifically, and the one I want to just hit on very briefly is SAFE. Back in the 70s and the 80s, Oregon was well known as one of the worst states to do business in from a workers' comp perspective. I know that even closer to home because my dad during those years was a workers' comp attorney, and life was good. My dad is still very sad about the reforms, the Mahoney Hall reforms and SAFE and everything else. So despite the fact that my family may not be as happy as otherwise would, I think it's a indication of the success of SAFE. And once again, SAFE wasn't designed, nor did it in fact actually drive out private insurance, you put your own spin on how you want to look at that, but however it did it, it was hugely successful in getting the rates of workers' comp insurance down to not only a manageable level, but a highly competitive level. As I understand now, doing workers' comp insurance is one of the most, is one of the best competitive advantages that Oregon has from a business perspective. So Mr. Chair, I just see a model that works. So you get the idea, is there a synergy there? Do we potentially create a new institution? I don't think so. I think even though SAFE is not structured to look at MedMal, it's structured to look at insurance. I think it is the right entity to take a look at this. And once again, this bill is just saying to develop a plan. It puts together a task force to do that. It does not actually say implement a plan. So at the end of this task force time, this task force is once again would be charged with actually saying here's the plan, but it would still be back to us to say, okay, flip the switch or not flip the switch. And I don't know all the pieces of information that are going to be part of that. I imagine it's a complex job and a complex look, but I think it's a complex look that merits a look. And given our need to get healthcare costs down, and given the challenges of providers in healthcare, I think it's just a good thing to do. So that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate you coming here, and I appreciate your efforts and your thoughts on this concept, and I definitely appreciate the fact that you sit on the health care committee. Not a committee assignment I will be seeking anytime soon. So those of you who do serve on it, I appreciate it. You're right. We do need to somehow get our health care costs in line. We want to make sure the young people that were educated in the state stay and work in the state, that go to our universities, that go to HSU, they stay and work here. And we do have a model structure, if you will, in dealing with complex, very complex, downright emotional issues like workers' compensation and costly issues. And it has become a model for not just this state but the country, and has kept our rates incredibly stable, and I'm eternally grateful for that.
Absolutely.
That being said, we're going to hear from the nice people from SAFE there. They have some concerns, I think they'll share with us, and I'm not so sure, and you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, that this is the vehicle, but it's a conversation starting point.
Yeah.
And I think, and my question to you, and maybe the good people back there, or HSU knows it, any other states attempting this on their own to create a state-ran malpractice insurance company comparable to what we have with our workers' comp?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not that I'm aware of. Now, I know that there have been discussions here in previous years. I'm not sure if those discussions ever got to a bill form, if they were more just discussions. But obviously, we haven't had legislation on that. I don't know about other states.
You got to start somewhere.
You got to start somewhere.
Representative Escobar, please.
Yeah, a couple things. One is a neurosurgeon at one time in Medford. If you bumped your head on a Wednesday, you were out of luck. We had so few. And a lot of it had to do with malpractice insurance. In fact, they pay $70,000+ a piece per year for malpractice insurance. I'm not sure that that's the right vehicle with SAFE, because I have had discussions with SAFE when, remember back, 20 years ago or so, they tried to get involved with medical insurance itself, and it proved to be falling over a cliff for them. So it'd be interesting to see what they have. But I think talking about it is a very good thing.
Well, and as I said, I don't think SAFE or any of us have the answers to this, but I think a formalized task force with certified smart people, that's why we do that. So,
mm-hmm. And I think that's a great idea,
yeah,
because the conversation's not going to go away.
Right.
Yeah,
the problems
are
solved.
Any further questions of the good representative while we have him here? All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Just say Ms. Rockland, you and or Mr. Davies, want to come on up?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brenda Rockland and Chris Davey from SAFE Corporation. I'm going to give you our bottom line on House Bill 2849 and then make one request. And following that, Chris is going to give you some information that we think you should have as you make your decision on this bill. So let me start with our bottom line. If the legislature and the governor want SAFE to sell medical malpractice insurance, we will figure out a way to do that to the very best of our ability. Here's my request. If you conclude that it's a good idea to have SAFE sell medical malpractice insurance, we would just as soon have you tell us to figure out a way to do it by a date certain, rather than have us study the issue for the next year and a half and then see what the next legislature wants to do. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation. And what we want to do this morning is really to tell you all the things that we don't know about medical malpractice insurance. And the first thing is that we don't know that our participation in this market would really make any difference to the rates that are charged to physicians. One of the reasons for that is that we don't know how well the existing insurance companies are serving that market. What we do know is that in 2007, it was a $110 million line of insurance in the state of Oregon. And just for comparison, workers' compensation insurance in 2007 was probably around $900 million. So it's a little over 10% of the size of the workers' compensation market. But obviously, $100 million in liability insurance is a significant amount that adds to the cost of health insurance in this state. The one piece of testimony that you have from us is a graph that looks like this. I see some of you are holding it in your hands. And this is information that we got from the Department of Consumer and Business Services about changes in premium rates over the last 8 years. And there are really two primary carriers right now in Oregon. One is CNA, and they have approximately a 41% market share. The other is Northwest Physicians, and they have approximately a 35% market share. And you can see, as Representative Bruhn mentioned previously, that the pricing of this product can be quite volatile, with big jumps in 2001, 2002, and 2003, but it's settled down, and in fact, over the last 3 years, premium rates for physicians have gone down. Northwest Physicians is the one that's had the biggest decrease, and in 2008, their rates were 25% lower than they were 3 years earlier in 2005. And again, to make the contrast with workers' compensation, which has been a successful story in this state, over that three-year period, our pure rates, the basic rate, only went down 4%. We don't know medical malpractice insurance. We've got a lot of bright people at SAFE who know quite a bit about workers' compensation, which is our core competency. But as far as I know, we don't have anybody who works at SAFE today out of our 880-some employees who has spent any time working for a medical malpractice insurance company. So there's a lot that we would need to understand. We'd have to understand capital requirements, because what we're really talking about here is creating a brand new insurance company from scratch. We would have to understand loss reserving, how to underwrite and price this product, loss control. We have a lot of loss control people, but loss control in medical malpractice is quite a bit different from workers' compensation. And then when you have a claim, the whole issue of defense, settlement, and the body of case law that surrounds that is all stuff that we would have to learn. There's a lot of difference between different lines of insurance, and whereas workers' compensation is mostly a scheduled line where you go look at the workers' compensation law and it tells you what benefit a worker can receive, medical malpractice or professional liability insurance is more a matter of liability and damages. And concepts such as non-economic damages and punitive damages exist in medical malpractice. They don't exist in workers' compensation. The next thing we don't know is where the money would come from. SAFE's money is all in one pot, and it's called the Industrial Accident Fund. And that single pot of money is a statutory trust fund that was created for workers' compensation purposes. It pays benefits, it pays the operating expenses of SAFE, and it's just one bucket of money. Some of you may remember that some of that money was appropriated 25 years or so ago. That appropriation was ultimately ruled to be unlawful by the Supreme Court, and the money was repaid with interest. And so the thought of using SAFE's existing funds to fund a new line of insurance is one that certainly raises some legal questions. And the fact that that money might be spent by SAFE rather than given to another entity probably doesn't change the answer. The Department of Justice has advised us in some other contexts that every expenditure that we make has to be related to workers' compensation purposes. And so the biggest demand for this line of insurance would be startup capital. Before we received our first dollar of premium, we would have to meet the regulator, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We would have to meet their solvency standards. And if we were thinking that perhaps in our first year of business we would maybe get a 20% market share, we'd be looking at perhaps $20 million in new premium. But a single claim can be very expensive, and this body's talked about tort claim limits, and often there is a reference back to the recent OHSU case, the Clark case, where the claim for damages in that case was $11 million for a single incident. And then defense costs are also considerable, and I added to that too. So startup capital for a venture of that size is likely to be in the tens of millions. I can't tell you what the exact number would be right now. Something else we don't know. And if we were working on this over the next year, using our existing staff to launch a new insurance company is also another question that we would have to determine whether that was legally consistent with the Industrial Accident Fund. And certainly hiring consultants, as we would need to do, would raise the same question. So we don't know if this would lead anywhere. We could spend the next year working on this, and potentially the next legislature in 2011 could say, well, thank you very much, you did a nice job, but we've decided we don't want to go there. And so the other concern that we would have is that we would be putting a lot of energy into something that is not our core function and perhaps could lead nowhere. So we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, before I open up, it's just this is a conversation inside of a much larger conversation that's a federal conversation as well. And it's one of those things I really don't know what to do, and I take you at your word that you're not set up to do that, and we have no money to do anything. My question to you, though, is, I mean, when you look at, I believe using the process of workers' comp and SAFE, I think that's actually a good place to look to see, to get started wherever we start. What, because it's long and colorful and painful at times and still unfolding every session. Constantly we're addressing this issue, which is good. What do you know historically, what was the startup money and where did it come from when we established SAFE? How did that happen? Do you have that history for me?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The SAFE began life in 1914. The initial startup funds came from the legislature. It was $50,000 in the first instance.
That's not very helpful, I guess.
And then there were a few more payments that rolled in over, I think, the next 10 years or so. So ultimately, there was about $1 million of startup capital.
Through
about 1925, yes.
Interesting. Well, we could probably do some math, figure out what is today's dollar. Any questions, any helpful questions here of these good people?
Are you suggesting they Representative Holby. Back with interest now or something?
Representative Holby.
Well, since you qualified it for a helpful suggestion, I'm trying to determine whether that's what I'm going to say is helpful. I'm kind of curious. When I looked at this bill at first glance, I kind of wondered why, and especially now hearing their conversation, why the legislature would direct SAFE to do this instead of going to our insurance division, who probably has a lot more expertise in figuring out insurance pools and the like. I think they're probably better suited to take a look at this subject matter than SAFE. Just a helpful suggestion.
And Representative, I wish we had invited them today, to be quite frank with you, and I think I'll follow up with that question of those good people. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris, you mentioned that these claims under medical malpractice could be very expensive, and in the event that the state had not reserved adequate funding to cover all medical malpractice claims, could that potentially jeopardize monies that have been reserved to pay workers' compensation claims?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that just gets to the whole question of where does the money come from?
Mm-hmm.
If the money source funds came from the general fund, let's say, and there weren't adequate funds, then I don't know what the answer to that would be. It possibly a new fund could be made part of the Oregon Guarantee Association, which makes sure that insurance companies that become insolvent or the beneficiaries of policies for insolvent insurance companies do get paid, and then that's kind of spread across the whole insurance industry. So I think that's one of the things we don't know. That's another thing we don't know at this point.
Thank you very much.
It's an excellent question, but I can tell you right now, I certainly would not support backing up that fund, the Workers' Compensation Fund, and I don't think you would find much support for that up here. Representative Cameron, please.
Probably more in the nature of a comment. It's kind of interesting when you add up Northwest Physicians in the last 9 years, their premium increase has been about 110%. So you can understand that's kind of way above inflation and part of the health care costs. And I wanted to thank you, Ms. Rockland, for your notion. If we're going to do it, why don't we ask you to do it? So appreciate that.
Well, any further questions of these good people?
Just a comment.
Yes, sir.
It occurs to me, and I mean, I was really intrigued, and more intrigued before hearing the testimony than I am now about this. But it occurs to me that this isn't about, or it ought not be about, SAFE providing medical malpractice insurance. It ought to be about a process that we had, and I wasn't frankly, I wasn't paying attention to what was happening back during the Mahoney Hall reform process. But I think it's about the reform process, and SAFE is the SAFE in its current iteration is the result of that. And so it seems to me that we ought to be focusing our efforts on a similar process for medical malpractice reforms, insurance reforms, and then if a new carrier were needed, then be looking at that. And maybe the existing carriers serve that market fine, but there need to be larger reforms.
And I think, really, and that's the intention of Representative Bruin. He just used this as a model more than anything. And included in your testimony is a letter from the good chair of the Health Care Committee, Representative Green. Like, you can read that at your convenience. I really any more questions of these good folks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And keep up the good work. Appreciate it. We had only invited testimony on this today, so in case anybody... Did anybody come from a long distance to testify on this? I recognize most of your faces. So with that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2849, and I'm open to public hearing on House Bill 2910.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2910 excludes sole practitioners from conducting professional real estate activity that is licensed by the Oregon Real Estate Agency. The measure permits individuals who are engaged in professional real estate activity as of a specified date to continue to engage in the activity as a professional real estate broker. You do have in front of you a -1 amendment, which clarifies the intent of the bill. The primary focus of the amendment establishes that a real estate broker can temporarily supervise the professional real estate activity of another licensee due to unforeseen circumstances or a temporary absence of the sole principal real estate broker, and that such supervision may not exceed 90 days.
Thank you. John Jillians. And we don't have the paperwork for this one today either. There is, I believe, another amendment in the works, and we'll hear from Sean, and if anybody else wants to come on up and talk, they're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I wish I was here to talk to you something exciting like medical malpractice and the dollars associated, but alas, we're going to talk about real estate licensing law for a second. It is my pleasure to bring to you House Bill 2910, and thank you for the introduction of the bill, Mr. Chair. I think Teresa did a great job of describing the bill and the -1 amendment. I'll just run you guys real quickly through the main points of the bill. In 2001, this legislature saw fit to make the transition over to what we call all broker licensing for real estate licensees. We created the categories of broker and principal broker. The last remaining subgroup from our former system is sole practitioners. This bill would eliminate that category and require for brokers who wish to operate independently to obtain a principal broker designation in the future. It's important to note that all current sole practitioners will be grandfathered in, and they'll be able to remain on their own without any additional requirements. The second provision of the bill, as found in the -1 amendment, grants the real estate agency rulemaking authority for our small and more rural membership, where you might have one principal broker and several brokers operating underneath them, to allow for unforeseen circumstances or for allow for that principal real estate broker to take a vacation and designate a broker to oversee the professional real estate activity in the office for a period no longer than 90 days. The specifics of the requirements for that broker will be developed in rule, and the agency has granted that authority. The final piece of the -1s is a clarification of advertising requirements for those licensees who operate in teams. We had a very good conversation this morning with the real estate commissioner about whether or not there a statutory change is actually necessary on this. So that's why you heard that we may need an additional amendment. This might actually be able to be handled under current rulemaking, and the board is meeting today, which is perfect timing on this. As I mentioned, we've had very good conversations with the agency on this particular matter. The commissioner is behind me, I'm sure, shaking his head, I hope, that we have, and that we'll come to agreement on a -2 amendment and move forward with that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, he's smiling, so we'll take that as a positive sign. Representative Escobar, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, being a principal broker at this time, you could go on vacation because of the activity that we have in real estate. I don't think you'd have to worry too much about it. The second thing is...
Carlos, Representative.
Why don't you explain to people what a sole practitioner is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel. A sole practitioner under the current statute is someone who had at least 3 years' experience operating as a broker and then decided to go out on their own. So they own their own company and operate independently of a principal broker. That's the basic designation of it. Going forward, the bill would make it so that new people would have to become a principal broker to do that, or the current ones would actually be grandfathered into principal broker status.
Thank you. Any, Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, and thanks for the question, Representative Esquivel. My question is, in that definition, it says acquired 3 years of active experience. Is there a quota, if you will, on how many homes you must have sold to be active, or is it just a matter of maintaining a license for that three-year period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, that is a good question that we've had a great deal of discussion on. Currently, it's 3 years of active experience. The issue that we run into when we start discussing minimum transaction requirements is particularly relevant to our commercial brokers, where if we set a high threshold, a commercial broker might work for an entire year on a single deal, and it would be extremely complex. So we haven't ever come to an agreement as to what those experience requirements would be. I will add, we have another bill in the Senate which increases our continuing education requirements, and part of that, and we hope that bill will come before this committee soon, Mr. Chair, part of that is a new test for becoming a principal broker. And in our discussions with the agency, we've talked about multiple choice and critical thinking components in that test, and the critical thinking components would demonstrate knowledge of a large number of transactions. So rather than having a set level for number of transactions, we feel that the test would do a better job of making sure going forward for principal real estate brokers that they have that experience.
Okay. And just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's just the word active is what, instead of 3 years experience, active seems to me like it must separate the difference between an experience of just maintaining a license and actually what you do with it. So that's the only reason I asked that question. Thank you very much for your answer.
I know my contractor's license is inactive. It's stamped inactive right off the front. I just pay the fee, a two-year fee. And if I want to go down and pay my bond and proof of insurance, I can and activate it. But I maintain it, I think, and I believe indefinitely. I just keep it just in case my wife wants me to ever go back to work or at a real job other than doing this. Any further questions of Mr. Jillian's today? All right, we'll go forth and do good. Anyone else want to testify today on behalf of this bill?
If not, going once, twice, three times, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2910 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3462.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3462 allows the Building Codes Division to establish temporary programs to train and certify specialized building inspectors to enforce portions of specialty codes. The measure outlines items being included in the rules for establishing the temporary programs and outlines the duties of a certified specialized building inspector. There is a sunset date on the bill of January 2, 2016.
I have Art Schlatt and David Eisenbeiss. You guys want to come on up? And we're not ready to do this one.
No, there's an amendment part coming up.
With your indulgence, could we ask Mark Long?
Oh, sure. We love to hear from Mark, too.
Thank you.
Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlatt. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And very briefly, Mr. Chair, this is a good bill, should pass. The bill basically provides some additional education and cross-training opportunities in the building inspection area. What we have is a situation in many portions of the state, rural portions of the state, and I might say some areas that you would say is urban, such as like Clackamas County and other areas where you have an urban area and then you have part of the county is rural in nature. What we have is the situation where a building inspector who basically does an inspection on a single-family dwelling cannot do minor electrical and plumbing inspection, because in those fields you have to be certified, and Mark can talk a little bit about that certification for those individuals. But if you're out in, let's say, Harney County or Lake County, and you need an inspection for, let's say, a little bit of electrical, if he's got a 7-Eleven, and you have a remodel of the, let's say, the bathroom facilities and that, and you need a plumbing inspector, that inspector has to come all the way from Bend, all the way down, let's say, to Lakeview, because the inspector in Lakeview that does single family is not doesn't have the accreditation to do a little bit of plumbing in a commercial structure, even though that plumbing might be very similar to what you would have in a single family house. So what we did was work with the building codes to see if we couldn't provide a little additional training so that some of these inspectors in the rural portion of the state can do just a little bit more work than what they currently do. This will benefit development and opportunities in the rural areas of the state. It will help expedite inspections, because if you have to wait for somebody to come 200 or 300 miles away, you have to schedule that. And it could take 3 or 4 days, so if you're working on a remodel or the development a structure at this point, you have to wait for those 3 or 4 days for the second inspector to come and do the work, do the inspection, and then you can resume, let's say, the framing or whatever at this point. So this is, I think, a good opportunity to help the economy, put us in a position so that when things do become a little bit more a little more generation in the economic area of the state and construction, that we'll be in a position to help citizens and contractors with building in the state at this point. We have worked with the trades on this proposal. We've had a couple of meetings with them. I was somewhat surprised to find, as we talked about to them, that they actually are very supportive of some additional cross-training, because they see that within their industries, people are getting close to retirement, and you're going to lose a sector that has that certifications at this point, so that they need to have people coming up in the ranks to provide the relationship between the construction and also the trades, and to be able to have projects move forward. So I think this bill has consensus, and it also is something that I think, as a pilot, we can see how it works and then come back to the legislature to have it extended at this point. So from a county's perspective, we urge the legislature to support House Bill 3462.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeis, League of Oregon Cities. From the city's perspective, I'd just like to add our support for House Bill 3462. We believe that this will provide better efficiency in terms of local government's ability to implement the building code, as well as better customer service for the builders that we serve. Right now, this seems to be predominantly a rural issue in terms of being able to find adequately trained inspectors. However, with the aging of the inspector corps, it could be more pervasive in years to come, so we are certainly interested in developing a system that introduces more flexibility in terms of identifying inspectors who are qualified and then training and developing inspectors for the next generation. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and thank you for your consideration.
Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Long, an administrator of state building codes. We're interested in this bill because of the flexibility that it provides. Just a little bit of background. We license or certify, is the technical term, the inspectors that are used in local government. And the system currently has two very, what I would call, rigid paths. You're either a residential inspector or you're a commercial. And in some cases, you don't need an inspector that has to be able to look at a high-rise hospital or high-rise building to do a small commercial installation. In other areas, we think we can provide through this bill and then subsequent amendments greater flexibility and emphasis in key emerging areas, whether it's green building, new technology. Last session, as Representative Holby knows, we spent quite a bit of time on construction defects. We think that this will help us tackle some of those issues from a training and certification standpoint on a broad basis and remove some of the rigidity that's been in the statutes for about 30 years on inspector training. I don't know if you have the dash one amendments in front of you or not, but you'll probably get dash twos then. And the purpose of the dash twos would be in meeting with industry and other folks as part of the informal work group around this issue, additional accountability measures were requested by several parties to make sure that if we are going to do this in a pilot area, that we're going to have kind of tracking and renewal, and we're going to align our inspector certification with our licensee processes that we have for electricians and plumbers and folks who work on boilers and elevators within the building codes division, and make sure that we have the same level of enforcement capacity that we do for those licensees that are in the private sector that we will for the certified individuals in the public sector. And then the last thing it does, it lines up the two programs so that they kind of operate the same, which we think that that's going to make sense. And then the last thing I'll state, my goal for some time is to develop a system that can get our worker and our inspector in the same place at the same time, receiving that training and kind of partner up a little bit better with the ongoing programs that are out there, and we think that this bill and the pilot is going to allow us to do that. With that, I'll be happy to take questions.
Thanks for coming, guys. As a builder, there's nothing more frustrating than waiting for an inspector. I can't imagine waiting 2 days because you're out in the hinterland. That would drive me crazy. And Lord knows, everyone in this building knows that I'm always searching for common ground to work with my good friends at the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Counties. So I really appreciate a bill like this. But Mark, to you, one thing I want to make clear, though, that it makes my antenna go up. I don't have any problem certifying a specialized building inspector, but I will have problems certifying any specialized builder. There's a lot of people that want to paint a lot of gray areas on a lot of this new green electricity technology, and I'm not one of them.
Sure.
Very bright lines there, and I want to maintain them. Just thought I'd share that with you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. This bill doesn't wade into that murky water at all.
That's very good. Thank you very much. Any questions of our good friends? Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to double-check that that this bill is being, I guess, vetted with the appropriate boards, the electrical board, the plumbers board, and boilers, and all of that, so that they have the ability to weigh in on this bill, as well as the building officials as well.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Holy. The bill asks us to get the advice of the various boards, and we've had some of the board members, in fact, had some here earlier that had to leave, involved in this as well. Again, this is a pilot. We're recognizing the need. We're recognizing the opportunities, but we are here to tell you that we don't have every single detail figured out. We've been talking since December, roughly, on this matter, and felt that a pilot was the best way to go about it. And unless I hear otherwise, Representative Holby, my board members and my industries are on board with this.
Right.
That's an excellent question. As a pilot, I'm sure those concerns will come out,
yeah,
and we'll hear from them and act accordingly. That being said, if you are building a small commercial structure out in the beautiful hinterland of Oregon, I'm confident someone who has the ability to inspect a resident, a new construction resident, I'm sure they can come up to speed to
to go and inspect a small project like that as well. Mr. Long, did you have to?
No, that's absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. And one of the other things, just to give you a sense of this, final inspections are an area where you're really going out just making sure last-minute things have been dealt with, and in some cases you have to send three different inspectors to go do that. And when you're traveling long distance, well, any distance for that matter, but long distance especially, the costs really go up. And we think we can deal with these kinds of things very flexible. It allows us to create levels, which is a little bit more rational than this hardcore residential versus commercial.
That being said, I would hope a structural inspector could also double as the erosion inspector. Anyway, any good question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is, and what this reminds me of is Adel and Lakeview. If you had some structure, small structure in an 8L, which we know will never be over two stories high, the individual could come out of Lakeview and take care of this instead of having to come out of Klamath Falls or Bend or whatever. And this will be a very good asset for rural Oregon itself.
Any further questions? Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with that comment. I guess my only concern would be that if we do a specialized training program, and I know it's a pilot, so don't take this as a negative on my end, but that we'd end up almost kind of compromising the integrity of the inspection programs to the point where you have a master of, I guess, jack of all trades, master of none type person. There are a lot of highly skilled people out there that do a lot of great work, and I know that it's not your intent to remove their work to have somebody come in and streamline that. But League of Oregon Cities, not that it surprised me to see on board, but I happen to know Gresham as a town is losing just about every fire prevention specialist they have to do fire code. They'll be looking for new ways to do building code as well, and they've lost some inspectors for building along the way too. I would sure hate to see this end up being a program that brought people in with minimum qualification to do inspections that should have been done to a further extent. And I don't think that's your intent. I do appreciate your work on this. I know it's a pilot, but that's what I'll be watching for.
Sure.
And I just want to echo that. We don't want to water anything down, and it's those hard-pointed questions is why we do this, and that's why we're going to have a pilot program, and if we find out that's happening, then we'll have to return here and see how we can make some adjustments.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
All right, any more questions of these guys?
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 3462 today? All right, seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing. Anything for the good order?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Teresa.
I do want to point out Wednesday's agenda. We have about seven bills that we have for work session in various capacities, so I will be checking with Legislative, Fiscal, and Revenue to see if we will have the paperwork. So the agenda may likely change, but as soon as I know the final lay of the land, I'll get as much information to you as I can.
And, folks, to quote my good friend and mentor, Alan Brown, there's a time to talk and a time to vote. Wednesday may be one of those times where we sit down and vote, so just come prepared.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Do we have a meeting on Friday?
Yes, we actually I'm posting the agenda, yes, in about half an hour or so, yes.
Got it.
All righty then. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.